My name's Emma Stafford and I'm head of the Department of Classics here at the University. We've had a number of successful liaisons with PVAC faculty in various areas and we hope to have many more, especially in the discussion of Greek tragedy and things related to it. Heracles' Wife, is this the only story that can be told? The play you're going to see this evening is an adaptation of a Greek tragedy, Sophocles' Women of Trachis, first performed in Athens at some point in the second half of the 5th century BC. It concerns Greece's greatest hero and what happens when he returns home to his wife of many years, Deianira, bringing with him the young and beautiful Iole. What I want to do in this very short talk is to look at the story behind the play and to think a little about the different ways in which this story has been told. Whenever modern writers, filmmakers, or indeed cartoonists decide to retell classical myths, some people tend to get a little worked up about how far they're departing from the original story. Disney's Hercules, as illustrated here, certainly invited such criticism by its slightly random inclusion of elements from other stories, like the winged horse Pegasus, who belongs to Bellerophon, not to Heracles, the helpful satyr Philoctetes, I won't even go there. In the case of The Wife of Heracles this evening, comparisons are inevitably going to be made with the original play by Sophocles. And some will like what's been done with the story, others may have other views. However, the point that I want to get across here is that the ancient Greeks themselves were constantly adapting their myths, telling and retelling the stories in different ways and in different media. We can't always reconstruct this kind of storytelling exactly, because many performances were informal, oral performances. You have soldiers around the campfire, you have partygoers at the symposium, you have mothers and nurses telling stories to their children at home. These are the kind of things we simply can't get at from this distance. What we have in the way of written texts, like Sophocles' Women of Trachis, is really only the tip of the iceberg. Sophocles himself would have been familiar with all kinds of stories about Heracles and would have picked and chosen which ingredients he wanted to include in his play. In addition to written texts, we do have quite a large body of evidence for other tellings of stories about Heracles in the form of images painted on Greek pots. Sometimes these explicitly relate to versions we know from plays, and sometimes they seem to be reflecting slightly different versions. Here, for example, we have a much debated case where the scene depicts the fit of madness in which Heracles kills his children by his first wife, Megara, not to be confused with tonight's wife. This is a story which is well known for Euripides' tragedy, Heracles. However, there are a number of elements in this image which are a bit different from Euripides' version. For example, in the play, Heracles shoots the children with arrows, whereas here he does seem to be picking them up and throwing them onto a bonfire. Slightly different, same effect. So some scholars would prefer to see this as illustrating a different version of the story. Just before we get on to some scenes which relate more directly to this evening's story, however, it's perhaps worth mentioning that in 5th century Athens, Heracles was only rarely depicted on the tragic stage. He was much more commonly to be seen in comedy and in the humorous genre of the satyr play. Here, for example, we see actors in costume preparing for a play about Heracles. We can recognise Heracles himself there holding his club, wearing a lion skin, but he's got his mask off, so he's very definitely an actor. And he seems to be having a chat with a guy dressed up to be Silenus, who is going to be the leader of the chorus of satyrs. Why this is relevant to tonight's play is because, as you'll see, there's a great deal of humour in it, especially in the first half. While possibly not a notable feature of Sophocles' play, humorous elements do in fact appear in a number of Greek tragedies, often discussed in relation to Euripides' plays, but the Athenian audience would have been very familiar with the idea of Heracles as a comic character, as a drunken, greedy, lecherous buffoon. We have a reflection of this kind of Heracles of the comic stage on this vase here, apparently fast asleep, rather fat, face down and naked on his lion skin amidst the debris of last night's party. There's an amphora there, a wine skin, what looked like chicken legs to me. It really does look like the morning after the night before. And some cheeky little satyrs are tiptoeing away with his bow and arrows and another wine skin there. Bear this image in mind when we get first to meet Heracles properly this evening in the second half of the play. And note also that while Heracles is chiefly remembered for his womanizing, the ancient Greeks were quite relaxed about the idea of him having a number of male lovers too. Now, onto some more specific elements of tonight's story. At the beginning of the play, Deianira makes reference to how happy her relationship with Heracles was when they were first married. In Sophocles' play, a bit more is made of this, because Deianira has a whole speech in which she tells the story of how Heracles fought with the river god Achelous, who was a rival suitor for her hand in marriage, and eventually won after breaking off the river's horn, just as is happening in this image here. Nice detail in tonight's version is that, although we don't hear about this history as such, we do meet a character called Charlotte Achelous, who I'd like to think is the wife of poor old Achelous, who he ended up with when he couldn't get Deianira. If you don't know the story already, I'm afraid I will give away a few bits, but certainly not everything. Again, right at the start of tonight's play, we hear of the death of one Sam Nessus, chauffeur to our hero, the footballer, Thomas Heracles. In the initial radio announcement, suspicion is raised that Heracles may have killed Nessus, and later on in the play this is elaborated upon with the suggestion that the murder could have been revenge for Nessus's sexual misconduct with either a willing or an unwilling Deianira. Both suggestions are made. Now, this is a vital element of the story because, as we'll see, the dead Nessus will ultimately be the cause of the tragedy which ends the play, even if Deianira may share some guilt. This is debatable in the deed. The audience of Sophocles' original play, however, may not have been entirely sure what to expect, because earlier versions of the story don't explicitly make a link with Nessus. This is actually our earliest source for the story of the death of Heracles, a poem called The Catalogue of Women, written at some point in the 6th century BC, so a good 100 years or so before Sophocles. This fails to mention Nessus at all, although it does to some extent exonerate Deianira by saying she did this terrible thing while greatly deluded in her mind, and this is not incompatible with this version. The idea of Nessus being Heracles' chauffeur is, I think, a rather nice way around the problem that in Greek mythology he's a centaur, a fantastical creature, half man, half horse, which clearly wouldn't fit in a modern setting. Even Footballers' Wives doesn't have centaurs in it. The story told in Sophocles' play is that Nessus was helping out by carrying Deianira across the river Euvenus when he tried to rape her. Heracles rushed to her rescue and killed Nessus on the spot. But as he was dying, the centaur urged Deianira to take some of his blood, which he promised would act as a love charm should she ever need one in the future. Now, this story was certainly well established long before Sophocles, as we find Deianira being carried by Nessus and Nessus being killed by Heracles in quite a number of images over the two preceding centuries before Sophocles. Now, literary sources both before and after Sophocles show some concern with the logistics of this episode. Some of them try to locate the rape in the middle of the river or on the opposite bank from Heracles and have Nessus killed from a distance with an arrow shot to allow a little time for Deianira to be persuaded to take the blood. Otherwise, it's a little difficult to see how this would work. But most visual artists like to show a good fight at close quarters. Well, somebody shooting with a bow is just not a good visual image. And so we tend to get either killing with a sword as there, or a rather younger looking Heracles rushing in with his club here. Here, Deianira definitely seems to be a sort of unwilling, distressed victim, insofar as she's holding out her hands in some distress. In this evening's version, what Deianira has received from Nessus isn't blood. Again, perhaps that might have been a little too gothic for the modern setting, but rather a bottle of, and we do all like this, foxglove liqueur. Watch out for the fairly early appearance of this bottle in Act 1 and for the subtle reference to it in the decoration of the set. It's really worth looking out for this. The more immediate catalyst for the tragedy, however, is the fact that Heracles brings home with him the young Iole. In our play tonight, she's the daughter of one Mr. Gandenza, who used to finance Heracles' football team, but has withdrawn his sponsorship because of the affair. In the Greek myth, Iole is a daughter of King Eurytus of Oechalia, a city which Heracles ends up destroying in his anger when Eurytus rejects him as a suitor for Iole. The story is again much older than Sophocles, though the details are slightly obscure. That 6th century poem we saw just now, The Catalogue of Women, alludes to it, listing the name of Eurytus' 4 sons. And after these he begat fair-haired Iole, on whose account the son of Amphitryon, that's Heracles, then there's a word missing, Oechalia. the crucial word must be something like fact or something like that. And I think it's pretty clear that ILA was already seen as the motivating factor for Heracles' actions long before Sophocles. An early moment in this episode seems also to be attested on this quite early Corinthian vase here, where Heracles is the figure at the very far right, reclining at a banquet with Eurytus. They've all got names attached to them. They're in very strange Corinthian script, so don't worry. Most people can't read this. And there is the figure of ILA waiting on them in between. This must be before Heracles has fallen out with the family. A further strand to this story tells of an archery contest for Iole's hand in marriage, which Heracles won, but the family refused to let him claim his prize. All sorts of possible reasons why. In fact, he's already married, might be one of them, but we can but speculate. Now again, the earliest source for this story, it's not attested in surviving literature for years and years and years, not until 1st or 2nd century AD, but as early as 500 BC, we have a couple of vase paintings like this one, in which the distraught Eurytus, the old man in the middle, seems to be trying to prevent Heracles from shooting an arrow at one of his sons. Again, everybody's given names in this picture. And there's at least one, possibly two sons dying at his feet. To the far right stands Iole. I don't think she's actually got arrows sticking out of her neck. I think she's meant to be in front of the target that they're all shooting at. But once again, she's holding out her hands in that entreating kind of gesture, perhaps asking Heracles not to destroy her family. But she's clearly fairly helpless. Now, this idea of Iole being a passive victim is fairly consistent in ancient versions of the story, including Sophocles' play, in which she's an entirely silent character, brought on stage along with a whole group of captive women. But as you'll see, tonight's Iole isn't quite so innocent. But again, I think this may be a necessary change for a 21st century setting, where a completely passive woman might not be all that convincing. Now, a turning point in the story comes when the long-suffering Deianira finally decides to use the present, the love philtre she received from Nessus, believing it to be something which will help her get Heracles back. In the ancient sources, this is always delivered via a piece of clothing. That passage from that poem we saw earlier, again, has her sprinkle poison on the tunic, a motif taken up in Sophocles' play and much followed by later writers. Sophocles also uses the herald Lycas to deliver it to Heracles. In tonight's play, that role is taken by, actually, Hylas, Heracles' own son, but I think the general idea of an innocent messenger is maintained. He didn't know what it was he was handing over. And there seem to have been variants in the ancient tradition as well. In this image, for example, it's a woman who is handing over the garment, and Heracles seems to be kind of swapping it for his lion skin, obviously a very bad idea. This could be Deianira herself, or there is another female figure on the other side of the vase, which might be Deianira, this might be a maidservant or something like that. I'm not going to tell you what happens at the end of tonight's play. Once the poison has been delivered, you will see. But in all the ancient Greek versions, Heracles is so racked with pain that he eventually orders a fire to be built, which becomes his funeral pyre. In Sophocles' play, we don't actually see the pyre and Heracles' death, but there was a tradition that the act of lighting the pyre was performed by one Philoctetes, nothing to do with the satyr in the Disney film, by the way, completely nothing to do with another guy. Philoctetes, son of Poias, king of a neighbouring city, and he's supposed to have been rewarded for this act of bravery by receiving Heracles' bow. This is what we see here, Heracles literally handing the bow and quiver over while he's reclining on his lion skin, which is rather splendidly spread on what looks like a not-yet-lit pyre. And this motif is quite important in linking the story to Greek mythology more widely, because this bow, Heracles' bow, is the very one which is fated to make Troy fall. Now, the whole bunch of stories all over again. And indeed, this is a topic that Sophocles treated in another play, the Philoctetes, perhaps for another year, George. I don't think I'm giving too much away by saying that tonight's play has a far from happy ending, and the same is true of Sophocles' Women of Trachis. The ancient Athenian audience, however, would have been well aware of versions of the story which didn't leave things there. What we see here may be inspired by a satyr play, this little satyr's running around at the bottom, in which they're inspecting an empty pyre in puzzlement, while Heracles himself is being whisked away in a chariot by the goddess Athena. Now, this story of Heracles' apotheosis, his becoming immortal, was known all over Greece from at least 600 BC. It was a very popular story. It shows up in vase paintings from different areas of Greece, as well as in quite a number of literary texts. And certainly in a lot of places, including Athens, Heracles was worshipped not as a hero, as you might expect, but actually as a god. And he was imagined to be permanently resident on Olympus, either feasting with the gods and even ending up, having moved on from Deianira for reasons which will become apparent, married to the goddess Hebe, who is youth personified, so he gets immortality and never-ending youth as well. This happy ending doesn't fall within the time span of tonight's play, but you might like to note a passing line which I didn't see in the script, but I'm sure I heard said by the PA Rhea, "Oh, Heracles, must be all right, he's immortal." That made me laugh. You probably shouldn't laugh, it's at a tense moment. In conclusion, I do hope that this very brief tour has demonstrated that there was a great variety in the way that Heracles was depicted in ancient Greece, and in the way that even this particular story was told. The reasons for this variety sometimes come down to the use of different media. Is it a picture? Is it a text? Sometimes to the desire of different artists and writers to shift the story's emphasis, perhaps to fit with changing social context, or simply with a view to the artistic effect thereafter. What the director and cast of tonight's play have done therefore stands within a very long tradition of adaptation. I leave you to judge for yourself whether you'd agree with me that this particular adaptation works very well indeed. Thank you. Thank you.